Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, sponsored by 1-800-DIALDJs.com and recorded live on blogtalkradio.com from the New Media and Outback Steakhouse Restaurant's capital of the world, Tampa Bay, Florida.
Detective Kate Beckett, NYPD.
Bridger Castle, just NY.
She's a reader of rights.
Police! New York City Police!
He's a writer of wrongs.
Who was murdered and was it gruesome?
They're New York's most unlikely partners in crime.
What are we playing for?
Pride or clothing.
And now a sneak peek of an all-new ABC's Castle.
Ah, just love this time of year. Crunchy leaves underfoot, the crisp, clean air, smell of jack-o'-lanterns all aflame.
Yeah, well, you wouldn't say that if you were a cop. Halloween's one of the worst weeks of the year for us.
The body's already in a graveyard. Someone's trying to save some time. I do love walking through cemeteries. I love the stories. Check out this one.
Elizabeth Dryden, December 3rd, 1962, to question mark? They don't even know when she died. What's buried her?
Are you wearing suspenders?
Oh, yeah, trying on costumes for my annual Halloween party. Costumes are mandatory.
What's the story, guys?
Wow.
Are you kidding me? Is that a stake in his heart?
Looks like Buffy's visiting the Bing Apple.
Someone thought he was a vampire.
So did he. And they're not plastic pop-ins either.
Are you telling me those are real?
Or high-end veneers.
Or he's a vampire.
No ID, no phone. We got guys sweeping the area for anything they can find. No witnesses either.
Looks like he struggled. I'm thinking he hit his head on a stone or someone knocked him in the head before he was stabbed.
Who would go to the trouble of killing someone that way?
Lycans. They've been at war with the vampires ever since Lucian was murdered in the 15th century. Again, this is just theory.
ABC's Castle. An all-new episode Monday, 10, 9 central on ABC.
One of the delightful surprises of last spring's crop of replacement TV shows was a quiet little romantic comedy called Castle on ABC. It stars Nathan Fillion as Richard Castle, a police procedural novelist who gets permission to hang around with an NYPD homicide detective, Kate Beckett, played by the beautiful Stana Katic. The show, which may remind viewers of a certain generation, mine, of Moonlighting, and younger viewers, perhaps, of Bones, airs Mondays at 10 p.m. Also in the cast are a number of strong supporting character actors, including Susan Sullivan, Debbie Mazar, and my guest today, Ruben Santiago Hudson, who plays Beckett's boss, Captain Roy Montgomery. Santiago Hudson brings some heft to what could be a walk-by role in someone else's hands. A Tony and Obie-winning actor, writer, and director, Santiago Hudson made his debut as a screenwriter with Lackawanna Blues, for which he received the Humanities Prize, a Christopher Award, take a deep breath, this is going to take a minute, the National Board of Review Honors, an NAACP Award, and an Emmy, Golden Globe, and WGA nomination. Now, people who listen to us regularly know I don't usually like to just read credits, but this guy's got some outstanding ones. On film, Santiago Hudson starred opposite Halle Berry in Their Eyes Were Watching God, Denzel Washington and Russell Crowe in American Gangster, Demi Moore and Kevin Costner in Mr. Brooks, Samuel L. Jackson in Shaft, one of my favorites, Al Pacino in Devil's Advocate, and John Travolta in Domestic Disturbance. He's also got a cameo in the new Ricky Gervais film, The Invention of Lying. Ruben, welcome to Mr. Media.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
That took my breath away. That's a lot of reading.
And you did it so well.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I practice in the school of nothing else to do all day, so what are you going to do? Hey, before I say anything else, congratulations. I read this week that Castle had gotten renewed for the full season.
Yay. That was big news around the set. We're still partying. I still have my very white voice today from, lifting the vino up last night saying, yeah!
Now, was it expected or was it a surprise when it came?
Well, hopefully, you know, we always expect the best, you know, but in Hollywood, you never know what the results will be. All we can do is go out and do the best work that we can with conviction, and hopefully the audience will buy it and come in and continue to support us. And they did, and ABC heard the audience's loud cry to Keith Castle, and they looked at our numbers, and they decided to let us ride, and hopefully we'll ride for a good while, and people will continue to watch the show.
I think I saw that the numbers this week were actually up even over last week.
Every week this season we've gone up, and with a little more push behind us and a little more publicity, and you know, talking to folks like yourself, you know, the numbers will go up every week.
Tell me how you heard the news. I'm kind of interested in this.
Well, my agent out of New York happens to be connected in so many different ways. Excuse me. And he heard that the rumor was coming around that we would get picked up, and that was a couple of days prior. But still, it's not official. And finally, I was home taking a nap here in L.A., and the phone rang, and it was my agent saying, "Woohoo! You know, you guys got picked up. It's official." And I was delighted.
So you got one of those woohoo agents, huh? Okay.
Yeah, he's great. I have one of the greatest agents in the world at the Gerst Agency in New York, in L.A., Stephen Hirsch. And he's been behind me for several years. We won't say how many, but he and my manager, Vincent Cerentione in L.A. here, you know, basically championed my career.
I would think that it would have to be a little nerve-wracking the last couple of weeks, even though the show has performed well, when you read about like Southland, which started about the same time you guys did as a mid-season show, and it got canceled before it's airing the first show of its new season.
Well, it's the hardest part of being an actor, you know, being at the disposal of other people's, at their discretion. Let other folks decide what's good and what's not good, what's going to last and what's not going to last. So it's more than nerve-wracking. Like I said earlier, you know, you just hope for the best and you go out and continue to do the work. And it's the fans that really speak the loudest. It's the people that watch the show. They don't care how good the show is to the people doing it and certain critics. They don't really care. They care about the numbers. They're about making money, drawing viewers. And we happen to be very fortunate because we've been drawing viewers pretty steadily. We have a strong base, and we're looking to build on that base.
Nathan Fillion was on this show with me sometime last spring talking about it, and I told him then, I'll tell you the same thing. I watched the show, and it's just, you know, it's one of those shows that I think you've been lucky that the network hasn't put too much pressure on, hasn't pushed it too hard, and it's actually, it seems like it's been allowed to find an audience, and I suspect it's going to be one of those stories where if you and I talk in April, it's going to have grown all season because people are going to discover it's very well written. The romantic comedy aspect is played just about pitch perfect, and it's extremely well cast.
Well, thank you. Fun group, too. A real, really fan of my group.
Tell us about how you came to join the cast.
Well, it's the same way most actors get their jobs, auditioning. The casting director in New York was very familiar with my work, Donna Rosenstein, and she suggested me. She and my agent, Stephen, talked, and I came in, auditioned. They liked it. They sent the tape to L.A. They liked it. Flew me to L.A. to screen test. I got past the production company. Then I had to audition screen test for ABC, the network, and I got past each level. But in the meantime, I was still hustling, auditioning for other jobs, hoping one would come through or two would come through, and then we would have some choices. I was very fortunate to get this particular job because the cast is so wonderful, the producers and the writers. Everybody's just really in sync, and what a delightful set. You know, if you're ever in L.A. and you stop by to visit us, I think you'd have a great time. Really fun set, great crew. I mean, from the makeup and hair all the way to the grips and the lighting design, it's just really wonderful. And I say that quite honestly, you know, and I've been in this business for over 30 years, and rarely do you get this kind of experience. So I went in and auditioned, and through the grace of God, won the role.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction the film roles that you've had, and you've also done spots on a number of TV shows. What does it mean to you as an actor, as a grown-up, to have a regular place to work week to week?
Well, as a father first, before I'm an actor, you know, my first responsibility is to provide for my family. And if I can do that in a craft, in a profession that I love, then I'm truly a blessed man. And I've been able to do that for my entire career. I haven't had another job since I've been a professional actor, which you're talking about now, 1981. I've done nothing else but act and write and direct. And so I'm extremely fortunate and to have a job like this in these times where so many people are suffering and scuffling, to have a job that I truly enjoy, I cannot tell you how grateful I am. I mean, I don't want to get mushy, but I am extraordinarily grateful. I'm on my knees by thanking God. I can't say enough about it, Bob.
I suspect, now you tell me if I'm wrong here, after what you just said about, you know, wanting to work and feed the family and that kind of thing, but I suspect that an actor of your range and experience might not have agreed to a part like this unless he saw some opportunities for the occasional episode with a little more meat in it for Captain Montgomery.
Well, you know, I always want more to do. I mean, when I'm directing, I want a player that wants more to do, you know, and a coach wants a player that wants the ball all the time. What I've learned in my maturity is that if you're patient and you're prepared and you're lucky, you get your opportunities. I've had 100 breaks. And I need 100 more before my career, before I go to retire. And, you know, I have to look at the total, the whole package, the integrity that I could bring to the role. Is there opportunity for my role to grow? Who am I surrounded with? Who am I working with? How understanding are they of the things that are important to me? How much can I get back to New York to see my family, which is like every 2 weeks? And they've been very understanding with that. So it's a lot of things to take into consideration, not just the meat of the role. I mean, I've won my Tonys, and I've won a lot of role awards, and I'm looking forward to be recognized even more throughout my career. Mm-hmm. But I have to take everything in consideration. And this was an ideal situation at this time for me. And we'll see what the future holds.
And, you know, in a given week's episode, how much are you actually, you know, are you? I want to ask this as respectfully as I can. Don't take it the wrong way. But, you know, in a given week, like this past week's episode, you had two scenes. I'm assuming you don't have to hang around all week waiting for two scenes.
No. Depending on how they schedule me, if the first agent schedules me on Monday and Friday, I can't go to New York because I'm leave on Tuesday and then I'm back on Thursday, and it's too hard. But when they're very generous, which they have been, where they kind of put my scenes together, if I'm working 3 days out of the eight, or they'll put me Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I can go away for 5 days and be at my son's basketball game, at my daughter's volleyball game, you know, see my wife. They normally accommodate me. When they cannot, I don't say anything but what time do you need me? And that's the sign of a professional, and I always like to consider myself a professional and conduct myself that way. They're considerate of me. I know when they can be, which is most of the time. Sometimes they can't. There are episodes like the one coming November 9th, which is featuring me. It's finally my episode. You see me. Well, I had to work 5 or 6 of the 8 days, from scene 1 to scene 5, every scene, every day. And I loved it. I mean, the days went very fast.
That's cool. I mean, I'm always fascinated by this aspect of the work because, you know, we see you for a short time. Obviously, it takes more than, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to do a shot. Mm-hmm. You've got to spend the day. You've got makeup and, you know, you've got to run lines and you've got to do multiple takes and multiple camera shots, all that kind of thing. But when you're not the guy who's on there for the whole 60 minutes, I'm just kind of naturally curious about the rest of your week. Are you able to book other work during the course of the shooting season, for example? Or are you, you know, you're pretty much locked in where you are and can't really vary from that routine?
I'm a writer and a director also, and very, very busy in that respect. So right now I'm sitting on film, a major motion picture that I'm writing, which I have to leave unnamed at this point until we get the green light from the star who they wanted, but it's a major studio. And so, actually, before I called you, I was sitting here writing since 6:30 in the morning. When I finish with you, I continue writing. Days when I'm off, I don't really have off. I write or prepare myself for the next thing I'm directing, which is usually theater. I'm directing in January a workshop of a new play down in D.C. And then come May, I'll be workshopping my new play, which is at the Public Theater in New York in development. So I have to be prepared, you know, prepare myself for that. So I never my days off, you know, because I'm multifaceted and I guess I enjoy keeping myself busy in all those aspects. Also, God gave me a lot of talent, and I like to try to use it as productively as I can.
I was going to say that really is the answer I was curious about, because it's like, how do you fill your time? And I knew that, obviously, I mentioned in the introduction, Lackawanna Blues, which you I think you you wrote and you directed and you acted in.
I did not direct it. I did not direct it. George C. Wolfe, the incredible George C. Wolfe, directed the film.
Oh, I apologize.
The play was directed by a wonderful a director named Loretta Greco. You know, it started out as a one-man play. That's what
Race
got its fame, and everybody, all the networks wanted it. Yeah.
And where, you know, you've continued to write, obviously. Where do you find inspiration? Is it from your own life? Do you have a very active imagination for other projects? Or, you know, what are you writing about?
What I'm very interested in is the history of my people, African-American people and Puerto Rican people, which has been, it's non-existent. You have to literally go, though it is existent and it's a reality, it's not in the history books. It's not taught in schools, but in a minor way, George Washington Carver and Martin Luther King, and maybe they'll mention Rosa Parks, Booker T. Washington possibly. But there are so many incredible contributors, people who have contributed to the growth and the wealth and the strength of this nation, who go, I call them unsung heroes. That is where my focus is. And sometimes those unsung heroes are common salt of the earth people like Nanny and Lackawanna Blues. So I like to tell the stories of a people full of integrity, a people full of respect, a people full of hard work and love and joy, anger and disdain, laughter. And that's my people. That's my grandmother and my mother and my father. And those stories are the stories that I like to tell, the hardest stories in Hollywood to sell, because I'm not dressing up like a woman, and I don't have a dwarf and a giant in it. And I don't have, you know, gangsters turning the 9mm to the side saying, you know what this is. So it's, my films are hard to sell, but they're beautiful to write, they're beautiful to read, and I think in time they will come to the surface, and you'll see a lot more Ruben Santiago Hudson projects, because I do have many. I mean, I was last night having a meeting about a gorgeous film I wrote that's in the drawer at HBO, and all of a sudden I decided, I'm getting ready to go at this film again. They let it pass that one time. The producer dropped the ball on it. Now that she's gone and they let her go, let me see if I can get this film out of the drawer. Let me attach a star to it. Let me take a meeting with my manager, and we'll go in and we'll push it. And if they don't want it, let's see if we can buy it back and push it somewhere else. It's a great film about babies that are dying in Zimbabwe, and how do we save babies all over the world. And it's a love story attached. It's a gorgeous film. But anyway, it hit me last night. Well, Ruben, you've got three films sitting in people's drawers. So anyway, I get inspired by human stories, and a lot of the humanity in my people has not been explored and shown and shared with people. And I think the images that we get to see, that people see, aren't truly who we are. The wholeness of who we are as people of color has been totally neglected in a lot of ways. And I'm here to kind of correct a little bit of it.
I hope I didn't take are there much. No. Are there people who are interested in these stories that, in a big way, or are you constantly struggling to sell and resell? And part of that, I wanted to ask you, I mean, how much did the success of Lackawanna help you to keep pushing these stories?
Lackawanna Blues said that the kid can write. Lackawanna Blues said the kid could write, which is me. But the naysayer said the kid can write his story. So when I turned in the next film, they said, oh, he really can write. And so now I'm on my fourth film. You know, people are very interested in what I write. I think I write very truthfully. I think I write in a way beautifully. I like characters. I like people in the way they speak. And I have a gift for it, natural. I'm not, you know, I wouldn't be the guy that you would get to write the next Chicken Little or, you know, something like that. When you talk about human stories, and the reality of it, the pain, the pathos, the comedy, the humor of it, the truth of it, I'm a cat. So people are always interested in when my name gets mentioned about writing these kind of stories. But sometimes I get so truthful about it, so honest, they become harder to sell. I don't get very theatrical. And you know, sometimes my representatives tell me I need to be more theatrical, forget about, you know, give them what they want more than pleasing my artistic sensibilities. And I just have not got to that point where I've just and I hope I never do, just fold up and just say, what do you want? Here it is. Boom. Then, you know, they can go to Kmart and get that. I mean, no put down in Kmart, but when you come to me, you come for a certain quality and a certain truth. And I think that will be the strength of my writing and my reputation.
And no disrespect to Kmart, but there aren't that many of them out there. So, you know, it's not really an option for most people. who is doing, as a writer, who's doing the kind of stories that you're doing and that you want to tell? And who's, you know, when you look at the marketplace in Hollywood and you see, you know, who's kind of doing what I'm doing and that's the career path I want to emulate? Who do you see?
That's the problem.
Hmm.
You and I can sit here for another hour and we won't be able to name anyone because they're doing it. But who's producing it? Who's putting it out there? These stories exist somewhere, but who's producing them? And that's the dilemma. That's my dilemma, and that's the dilemma of a lot of writers here who feel the way I feel, and which I don't run into many, but that are adamant as I am. As some people in Hollywood tell me, I have an agenda. I'm trying to uplift a people and an image, and an agenda does not sell in Hollywood. What sells is what's commercial. And I say, well, this is who I am. I'll make my living over here doing a TV series, having fun, directing a Broadway play, enjoying that. And then one day when I bring the right forces together, we won't have to go to other people and knock on doors. See, people who produce your stuff, either it's to make money or it's important to them, this story. And so I have to find out who my stories are important to, who this story that I want to talk about, the Harlem Renaissance, who is that important to? And whoever that's important to, let's sit in the same room and come up with a plan how you can make money and we can still tell our stories.
Has the digital age given you opportunities that were not there 10 years ago? I mean, could you find someone and produce these films for online distribution, or is it, you know, just not big enough and you know, productive enough to do that?
Well, you can do that, you know, but I think films online, that's a whole another. We haven't gotten there yet, really, I don't think. Webisodics and little episodic little moments we can do. But when I talk about trying to do the Harlem Renaissance as a miniseries, when I talk about coming into your home 4 nights or 3 nights to tell this huge, incredible story of a time in America when black people were kings and queens. Basically, people came from all over the world to party, to hang out, to hear the music of Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington and Basie, and to hear the poems and read the novels of a Gene Toomer and Claude McKay, Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston. You know, the art of Richard Barthes and William H. Johnson. I mean, if I can come into your house and share this story, this music, these tales, these political views, this socioeconomic situations that we were in during the Depression, pretty much coming out of the Depression. You know, you need tens of millions of dollars to do that, and that's not on the internet, and that's not in digital. I can advertise it. I can keep talking to you and talking to people till people say, you know what, I like this cat. I'm with this guy. You know, and the advertising through digital and through internet is amazing. But as far as getting things done on the level I want to, I don't think we've reached that place yet.
And, Ruben, talk to me a little bit about the mechanics of your writing. Are you a longhand guy? Do you work on the computer? Do you have to be in a certain place physically? Or, you know, paint the picture of the room for me.
The picture of the room is the picture that I'm looking at right now. Right here on my desk, I have 4 books. Let me turn my head. 4 books, 3 yellow pads, 2 scripts with notes on them that have already been written and I've taken notes on. Now, over here on the coffee table where I'm sitting now, close to with my foot on it, I have two scripts of Castle also on the side, 2 yellow pads, 2 books, and my computer. I write on my computer, and then I take notes. And I take a lot of notes as I'm walking through in the day, ideas that come to me. And things that come to me, and then I come and I apply them to the computer, what I have on the computer. You know, so it's just I surround myself with the knowledge, I saturate myself with the time, the place, and the information, and then I attack it. I burst out with the story and start writing until I can't write anymore and I put it away. Or I realize, wow, my neck is hurting or my hands are hurting. Go out and get some dinner, you know, relax, meet a friend, watch a baseball game, watch football, you know, and then you chill. And then I try to live for the weekend, you know, Sunday football and Saturday college football, and hopefully I get home to see my kids' games and, you know, that kind of thing. So I balance it pretty well. I don't inundate myself with just writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I let it come when it comes. I don't force it, really, and sometimes that's a problem.
Okay. Well, and let's come full circle back to the acting. You have you've been in some terrific films with work with some, you know, some really big stars. Do you have a few favorites?
Actors.
Actors and film roles.
Well, you know, I'm very partial to. Most of the actors in Lackawanna Blues. I mean, Jeffrey Wright is one of my favorite. Jimmy Smith is one of my favorite. My all-time favorite died. He was a best friend, Gregory Hines. Denzel and I have a great time. Sam Jackson. You know, Hallie is definitely at the top of that list. I mean, I can go on and on because I've been fortunate enough to share camera time with all of these people and also to share meals with them. You know,
mm-hmm.
These aren't just people we pass each other in the dark. I mean, I was last night when I was celebrating the pickup, I ran into a young brother who I've been mentoring. He works in a restaurant here, and he said, you know, Mr. Jackson was in the other night, and I told him how much I admired his work and I wanted to work with him, and he looked at me kind of side-eyed. This is what the kid told me. He said, then I said, if you have any doubts about my work, just ask Ruben Santiago Hudson. And Sam said, no, hold on now. Hold on, Ruben was at my house 2 weeks ago having dinner. Now I will ask him. So these are not just colleagues, but they're friends. And when I talk about doing big projects, I know that I can always count on them. You know, though they're not producing these kind of films, they're willing to be in with me to get them produced, and that's a good thing.
Well, and tell me something that will make me feel better about the fact that you've been at close quarters with Halle Berry. Without the makeup, she looks like your grandmother, right?
I cannot tell that lie. Halle is gorgeous with the makeup, without the makeup. You know, I've had breakfast with her and I've had dinner with her. You know, we were shooting Solomon and Sheba in Morocco. You know, we get up and have oatmeal in the morning. I meet her at the restaurant, and she was as gorgeous in the morning as she got out of makeup. And
yeah.
Plus, more so, her heart. It's just very rare to find a person that kind and that beautiful. You know, vanity is something, and she just does not have it. It's a dangerous beast. She's not a vain person. You know, she's just Halle, you know, which is cool.
Well, two last questions. We'll let you go. If you had to apologize for one role in your career, what would it be?
Oh, you know, I'm going to get myself in trouble on this one. It would be the role I played in Mr. Brooks. Because
really?
They threw a scene in on me that they cut to get me to do the movie, and then they threw it in. And I fought with it when Demi hits me. I said, she cannot, I'm here to protect her. She cannot beat me. I'm not when I'm her protector. You know, because why let me protect her? And so that was a big dispute. If I could rewind the video, I mean, everything does something for you, your career.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thankful for each opportunity. I must tell you, I'm very thankful. But when I was deceived in that moment, it made me say, you know what? If I can rewind this videotape, I would have never trusted it. Did I have a great time up until that moment? Oh, buddy, did I have a great time in Shreveport. When that moment presented itself and I knew that I would do something that I didn't want to do and be involved in, but to keep everything flowing, and after the big argument, we did it. I mean, it haunted me because the next time, as soon as the movie came out, I'd be walking in New York City, and some kid would be screaming out, Demi Moore beat you up! And it's not so much of getting defeated. It's like, you gave me a purpose to protect her, and I couldn't even protect her from me. So, I talk about integrity and through line, and that wasn't my through line of my character. And even through the movie, I kept saying, let me add something to the equation. Let me find the bullet hole. Let me say we should watch this guy. Let them see why I'm her superior. In Castle, you see that every week, even if I have one line. Let's go pick this guy up. Get to it. Go get over here. Well, what do you think happened there? Well, tell me. Lead me on. Tell me. All right, let's get to it. You know, I make decisions in Castle that are informed decisions, then I am in charge. I don't have to always be in charge. But if you call me captain, you call me captain for a reason.
Right.
So I should honor that position. And I didn't think in Mr. Brooks I honored my position.
Well, you gave a very honest answer to that question. So here's
the bonus.
So I'll never work again. No. You're going to work a lot more than Demi Moore, I suspect. I wouldn't worry about that.
I like Demi Moore. I like her.
I'm sure. I just don't see her doing a lot more than getting photographed for Twitter by her husband these days. Finally, this question. If there was a role, and this is you answered that question, so I give you this one. If there was a role that you wish folks had seen but didn't, what would it be?
That I've already done?
Yeah.
Does it have to be in film?
Anything.
The one-man show, Lackawanna Blues.
Hmm.
That was the most rewarding, enriching, life-changing role that I have ever had, and even though I had to write it for myself, it was just the love letter to Nanny, to my mama, that made it so rich, so pure, and so infectious to the audiences that came to see it, why it overwhelmed people, and they were on their feet before the lights can go down for the curtain call. My quest and my goal is to put that show back up and bring it around the country again, because I took it to 14 cities, and we sold it out in 14 cities, and we had standing ovations, myself and my musical composer and partner, Bill Sims Jr., who was my partner on that project. We went all over this country, and we cried, and we laughed, and we just felt that everybody in the world has a nanny or wants a nanny, that warm blanket of security, and so we had to continue this show and put it back up. So I figure in the next couple, 2-3 years, I'll put it back up, and I'll bring it around again, but that's the role. And that's the show, more than the role, mm-hmm. that I wish everybody could see.
Very good. Well,
but I just want to, before we hang up, I just want to,
yeah.
Are you in Tampa, Florida?
St. Petersburg, yeah.
Yeah, my sister's down there, Doris, Bridget, and I just want to say hello. I hope they're listening. And a lot of my family's down in Tampa, and my brother-in-law, Jim and Dawn, they're there, and sister-in-law. So, you know, I got a lot of family down there. So, hey, y'all, you know, if you're listening, hope you're having a good day.
Well, tell them to listen. We'll get them the information. That's a nice surprise. I talked to Rick Fox a little ahead of you, and I mentioned that he had done a Tyler Brown movie with Angela Bassett, who was born here in St. Petersburg. So we're always looking for local shout-outs, so thank you for that. let me tell everybody. Folks, you can catch up on the episodes of Castle that you missed at www.abc.com, and you can now order the complete first season DVD of Castle on Amazon.com or MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. And don't miss Ruben Santiago Hudson in new episodes of Castle, airing every Monday on ABC at 10 p.m. through the rest of the season. Ruben, congratulations on that, and thank you so much for joining us on Mr. Media today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, all right?
My pleasure. Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And for more interviews with TV actors, directors, producers, and screenwriters, surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Castle star Nathan Fillion, as well as the men and women of Chuck, Lie to Me, Southland, and many more. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites, whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, blogcritics.org, TrueSlant, Pointer Online, Digital Journal, Vox, MediaFly, PodFeed.net, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, Current, or Odeo. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/Andelman or facebook.com/Andelman. Thanks for joining us today. Always appreciate when you share a piece of your day with Mr. Media. Talk to you real soon, everybody, and thanks for listening.